We'll start with like the broader questions, and I think we'll get in, I'm sure, pretty quickly to your issues about the role of housing and house prices, where you've written extensively. But to start off, how is it that you view the causes of the crisis, the broad causes of what happened over the last several years in the U.S.?
Well, I published a book in 2008 called Subprime Solution, and in that book I give my own version of the causes of the crisis. And it will sound more sociological or psychological than most accounts. That doesn't mean that I'm fundamentally different in my interpretations, but I guess I like to trace it back a step further. I think fraud and bad dealings was part of the crisis, but that doesn't mean that we stop there, because why did we have all of these bad dealings? It has something to do with something deeper that was going on. So I'm less likely to point to malefactors and think, I mean, although I still would do that too, but I like to think of it more as a social phenomenon, which makes me maybe more academic, I don't know, but it's the way I think about these. And it is kind of, I think I'm different than most economists in thinking that way. I also have another book that I wrote with George Akerlof in 2009 called Animal Spirits. And once again, we think that there was a social epidemic, a change in thinking that is the real underlying cause of these kinds of crises.
I'm sorry, Professor, a change in?
A change in
thinking.
Ways of thinking,
oh,
yeah.
Professor.
This is behavioral economics, but it's also a kind of a sociological take on things that behavioral economics is a revolution in the field over the last 20 or so years, but it tends to be more psychology than sociology. But what I'm thinking is that this crisis occurred ultimately, I think, because of a change in thinking, a change in our culture that brought on all these other things.
So to probe a little deeper, is this people have pointed to different changes in thinking. Do you have in mind changes in thinking at the level of households willing to run at higher debt levels, changes in thinking
right.
among corporate CEOs and risk tolerance?
It's all part of a boom psychology, right. And this has happened many times in history before. There are similarities and there are differences across booms. They're basically similar in a kind of psychological stance of optimism and envy of other people's successes and wishes to get involved and negligence about the details, trust is high. That's common to all booms that precede crises, but there are always specific institutional differences or intellectual differences that set them apart.
That's interesting, Professor Schiller, because I've heard said before, and I have read The Subprime Solution. For centuries we've had those kinds of booms, but seldom, if ever, have we had so booms so close together, so well documented, and so similar as the dot-com boom. If you look
right.
at your book, you'll. If you look at your book, I don't know. If I can
look at it,
if I can recommend your book to you. If you look at the disparity between the dot-com prices got out of whack with expectation, and then just a few years later, you can show people how housing prices grew up, housing and rental prices grew out of whack. You had the same phenomenon two times documented in such close period. My question is, why don't we ever learn?
We learned for a while. But it always seems different. I don't know if you talk to the this time is different people of Rogoff and Reinhardt, but maybe you did. But they talk about a this time is different syndrome. I don't know if it's a syndrome. It's like things are always different. Maybe we're subject to kind of an illusion that the troubles of the past are really behind us. There's a sense of modernity that is always there, that we're smarter now than we used to be. But it's also just that the world changes in confusing ways, and people really don't know how to extrapolate, things that happened, whether we could really have another crisis like the 1933 banking crisis. They're just big unknowns, and when they're so unknown, then they're kind of, people's opinions are driven by their psychology.
Right, but there's people on one level like me, and then there are people who are the experts who don't seem to recognize these things. Shouldn't they be better at it?
Well, see, the problem is experts are very good in concrete things. You bring in an engineer and ask them to build a power plant, he or she knows how to do that. But when it's something about, what about a housing? You know, the amazing thing is, people thought that we couldn't have a housing price decline. That was a widespread view. That they'll say home prices have never fallen, and they can't fall. And so we just don't have to build that into our models, that it could ever fall. Or if it could fall, it wouldn't be very much. Now, yeah, there's a question there. How can all these smart people adhere to such a... there's no economic theory saying that. How do they all get on that wavelength? Well, this is it's a sort of conventional wisdom that it gets established. Everyone specializes in something or other. This is the human society that we live in. And we get really good at something. And most of us just, you know, blank out when something isn't related to our specialty. It's too hard, you know, we can't do everything. So we assume that everyone else is taking care of it. And that's what happens. So smart people make big mistakes.
So thinking about, this house price dynamic, right? The expectation clearly got set that house prices would rise or continue to rise. Do you have a sense for how that starts?
Well, I mean, I think we had a classic bubble in housing prices, but it was preceded in the United States by other bubbles. You know, there's like three of them. There was the bubble of the 1970s, which was more tied to California, and I don't have as good data about that one, but it seemed like it was regional. And it didn't really burst, you know, it kind of flattened out instead of bursting. People with the recession of 73-74, they kind of lost it. It wasn't booming anymore. But that became kind of a model that, you know, we really saw home prices charge ahead in some places, glamour places like Los Angeles. And then we had another such bubble in the 1980s, and this was primarily on the both coasts. And Boston had a very sharp boom. And once again, home prices actually did fall this time, but not by very much. So it kind of primed people. The word was getting out more universally that homes are a great investment, was the idea, because they had gone up a lot and were perceived as having the potential to go up indefinitely. So it wasn't exactly, you know, I don't know that people had a clearly worked out model. They knew that there had been these big surges in home prices that really weren't reversed very much. And that they had the idea that because we're running out of land and the world is growing, housing is this great investment. And when they saw prices going up again, they thought it's a no-brainer, you know? I'll buy two houses and borrow as much as I can. And it really seemed like a no-brainer. But it was kind of a reaction to past crises, not crises, past booms, the lack of a really serious retreat afterwards. And it kind of spread more and more across the country. It became a conventional, a kind of an intuitive view that in the 2000s bubble was almost everywhere. And that's the difference. It became a massive event. So it was a kind of a sequence of experiences that people had. And I also want to mention, if I'm not going on too long, the efficient market theory, which was emerging as a prominent academic theory. Somehow, it seemed to go along with, I don't know why, but because efficient markets doesn't say that prices can't fall. But it somehow left people thinking that the markets are always right, and the markets are confirming this notion that we're running out of land, and it's just a great thing to do to get into real estate.
Are you of the view, so if I look at the house price, it's always tricky if you use the nominal or the real series. But at least in nominal terms, they'll start rising in the mid-90s until their peak and then the collapse that we all witnessed.
Yeah.
Are you of the view that some of that is justified by fundamentals, either changes in the mortgage finance market or shifts in preferences or some other, you know, underlying fundamental economic phenomenon?
Well, I'm sure some of it is. I don't know that very of the 90s boom.
Well, starting with the 90s through the 2000s. I mean, so do you draw a break?
I see. This latest boom.
This latest one, yes.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. It's a difficult question. I talk about this also in Subprime Solution. You have to break it down. I tend to break it down into three parts: land, construction materials, and construction itself. And ultimately, if there were no land constraint, then it would be pricing housing would be like pricing automobiles, right? I mean, you'd have to look at the cost of the materials that go into them and look at the labor cost of producing them, and, you know, that would pretty much dictate the price. It should, right? Because, I'd make this parallel to automobiles because you don't hear anyone worrying about the price of automobiles getting out of hand. But it's really similar, right? A house and an automobile, they're both kind of structures, right, that are mass-produced, and there's an industry making them. But people seem to view them very differently, and that's psychological, I think. I think cars and houses are more similar than most people realize.
So even though they both have depreciation rates, and yet we view one as a capital investment and one as a simply depreciating asset?
That's absolutely right, yeah. You don't hear of anyone buying cars and warehousing them, storing them, to sell them in 20 years. Because people think, well, they'll be obsolete by then, right? I mean, maybe if it's a very unusual DeLorean or something, you could do that, but you just wouldn't do that. But they will do that with houses. And they don't make a clear distinction between the house and the land. Because if you buy a home in Manhattan, you're much more buying land than if you're buying a home in anywhere else in the country. So there are some areas where housing is land constrained and it becomes more of a land investment. But this is another thing that changed in our thinking. And it's partly endogenous to the boom, that we thought more, we begin to think of housing as more and more land. And it's true that in some places, most of the value of the house was in the land. But that was part of what changed our thinking. If you really think of housing as structures, they don't sound like a good investment anymore. I mean, I could buy plywood and warehouse that. We have a lumber's futures market. If you want to play that game, you don't even have to buy the plywood. But that's not what people were thinking, right? They were thinking about land, I think.
So that's an interesting.
But they weren't buying agricultural land, particularly. Although there was a boom in land. That's another boom that you have to look at to understand. There was a boom in agricultural land prices too. Peaked later. So that kind of confirms my idea that it's this running out of land theory that was in the back of people's minds.
How does that apply then to, say, the sort of massive boom in condo prices that we saw?
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing. Now, condo prices are they have a much lower land component, especially if they're in high rises, right? And then it becomes construction materials. I mean, what limits the... I have this very simple economic model that is not talked about very much. It is that cost, in the long run, drives price. This is elementary microeconomics. And, if the price gets above cost of production, they'll make more. And they'll dump them on the market, and that will bring the price down back to cost. If the price falls below cost of production, the construction industry will shut down. They won't make them if they can't sell them for what it costs to make them. So there'll be a supply shortage, and the price will go up. This was known and talked about half a century ago, or maybe a century ago. Economists thought that housing was driven by construction costs. And the whole stance, when you look at what the media say about home prices, which wasn't much, it was all, I think, implicit that they thought of them as kind of bad investments, but, you know, a good thing to have because you have a family. And if we want to think about where prices are going, you have to take account of that they're building them, and they can make them more efficiently now than they could 30 years ago. That was the stand. But it kind of lost, culture changes and the emphasis changes. And this Manhattan model, which is the model that when you're buying a house, you're buying land, became the imagined model for everyone, including places like Las Vegas, where there's abundant land around. So, and, you know, the house is mainly just the structure.
So from the person buying the house, that's exactly where I was going to go next. The person purchasing that house in Modesto or in Vegas, where there don't seem to be substantial land constraints, some people have argued that there are regulatory constraints to building, but in terms of availability of land, clearly that's not a large constraint. Did that, they somehow just transposed that model, that Manhattan model, as you called it, over to Bakersfield, Sacramento, Modesto?
That's right, because they're not professionals. I mean, they're not, this isn't an industry where you've got, like in the stock market, you know, a whole profession that trades the thing every day and has computers, data. It's everyone. Those people have been kept out. We tried to create a professional market for single-family homes. We created a futures market at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and that hasn't done well. One of the things I don't understand why it didn't do well. Maybe it will yet, but we just don't have professional interest in trading these things. And so the theories that dominate what the market does are theories, you know, that your neighbor has. I mean, anybody has, and they don't read about. You know, newspapers now have these real estate sections, but they don't talk about such basic economics as supply and demand and construction costs and relate that to home prices. It's just not there. It's written by journalists, and people just never figure it out.
So, the home purchase is the largest purchase most people make, and you're right that they do it only a couple times in their lifetime, so we don't expect many consumers to be expert at this. What about the point of view of lenders? Are people willing to give someone $200,000 or $250,000 for a house? Again, let's say in a land unconstrained area where it's not obvious that you can sustain that level of a price. Do you have a sense for their motivations or their thinking at the time that they were willing to make those loans?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to understand it. There's different aspects of it. First of all, whether they securitize them or not. Some of them did not securitize them. They held them in their own portfolio. And they did this with the same thinking that the people who bought the houses had, that namely home prices will go up indefinitely, and it's a no-brainer to get into it. You know, it really is attractive when you really think about it. We had home prices go up dramatically every year from 1997 to 2006. And as every year goes by and you see home prices going up again, you get more and more convinced that this is just the new world order. So I'm sure that some mortgage lenders were sincerely, some of them were certainly getting involved. They thought they were helping the homeowners and getting them past any obstacles. And I think some of them had a sense of mission in dealing with low-income subprime borrowers, and they thought that what they were doing was getting them on the same money machine that other people have been in on, and they deserve that too. That was one mode of thinking that I think was, but that's not the only mode of thinking. There was a more cynical variety as well, and they were the people who securitized loans and didn't believe in them themselves, but said, well, nobody's asking me, so I'll just do it. You know, I'll securitize them and sell them off. And they found that the rating agencies were willing to rate highly these securities, and so they said, okay, I don't care, it's not my department, right? I'm doing this legally, officially, I'm giving the information that's correct information to the rating agency, and they don't care, so I don't care. And so it's kind of a division of responsibility that left some of these lenders doing something that they themselves didn't believe in.
Do you have a sense to the degree to which the home price dynamic itself, the rapid appreciation over those 10 years, is an endogenous response to this increased financing and increased level of securitization?
Well, it's partly that, but it's partly something that would have happened anyway. I don't know how to disentangle them. We can have a bubble without any change in lending institutions, but it will be not as big. If the lending institutions were constant, that people could have bid up home prices somewhat, but then they would have become stretched in their ability to finance them, and that would have slowed it down, but we would have still had a bubble, I think. But then it's not surprising to me that lending institutions do this, because it seems to me that the very environment that encourages people to buy more housing and borrow and try to borrow to do it, that creates opportunities for lenders, and who are often of the same mindset as I was just saying.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to regulation, that also affects it. In other words, the same bubble thinking affected the regulators. I talked about this in my Subprime Solution book. I gave talks at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the FDIC in 2005, before the bubble burst. And I tried to urge them then to tighten up. And I listened to them, and I found them to be people who already had thought about these issues a bit, or at least a bit. And they had people around who were worried about the bubble. But they didn't think that I had any authority, or the people in their group had any authority to justify any big crackdown. And so it was like common knowledge is that it's okay. You know, we're hearing you. Maybe it's not okay. But we just don't see any concrete reason to believe you, so we can't justify any action.
That was which agencies did you talk to?
I did the OCC and the FDIC.
So it sounds to me, and that particular anecdote is one of sort of a bunch of economic actors, be they regulators or homeowners or lenders, who are all sort of busy in updating. And
yep.
They get the belief that, you know, some expectation of house prices, and then it's going to take a lot of new information. In the end, it took a lot of new information to knock them off of that position. Is that sort of how you're thinking about this?
Right. Well, the strange thing about it is that the kind of information that was getting out was not the essential information. You know, we had whole TV channels, the Home and Garden TV. We had lots of information about the housing industry. But when I wrote my second edition to Irrational Exuberance, I tried to find a 100-year-long series of home prices so I could compare the current boom with previous booms. And I found that there was none, not for the U.S., not for any country. And isn't that odd? I mean, you'd think some scholar would have wanted to put a comparison. And there was this widespread belief that home prices only go up, and no data. And I found that there were price index series that someone had published long ago and were just forgotten. And I was able to dust them off, find them, and splice them together. And then that's when I discovered how dramatic was the current bubble. But it seems like, isn't that odd that nobody else did that? It reminds me of in the 1987 stock market crash. I decided, this is about the stock market, I decided to do my own questionnaire survey of both individual and institutional investors right after the crash. I did it the week following the crash. And someone said to me, well, surely somebody else will do that too. But it turns out nobody did it in the world. Not right after the crash. The Brady Commission did a survey months after the crash. But, you know, it's like there's a certain economic theory, I guess, that pervades. And nobody wanted to do a survey asking people why they were selling on October 19, 1987, because economic theory said it must be some good obscure reason, you know, some new information. And there's no point in asking because it's the best judgment of the market, this efficient markets theory. And the theory got so pronounced in people's thinking that nobody ever collected any data that might have, you know, under the alternative theory, maybe we should collect the data while we have, while memories are fresh. Nobody did that. So, you know, it seems like our theories, you know, there's not much interest in collecting data that might eventually support some alternative theory that's not in favor now. It just doesn't do anyone's career any good to collect that data. So we end up not even knowing the fact. That's a problem about human society that, you know, I'm not criticizing any institution or any. It just seems like we're rather herd-like in our behavior in many walks of life.
I think it also speaks a little bit to our professional, I'll withhold full judgment, but Most assistant professors in the economics profession will tell you that they're not going to get tenure or be rewarded for the new cool data series.
Absolutely right. Especially a data series that you have to start collecting, and it doesn't amount to anything until you've been doing it for 20 years. So that's absolutely right.
I think that's right. One of the interesting things about your data series, I'm wondering if you've seen research about, is there's a historical precedent for a structural break in the house price series. Post-World War II, where there doesn't seem to be a large rise and then a flat period for decades.
Right. I talk about that in my book.
Okay.
And that seems to be a very different break because the whole national psychology was different then. It was after World War II, and the housing market has been shut down for the duration of the war. The housing construction industry has been shut down, so there was a shortage of housing. The GI Bill had promised help in financing for veterans, and it seemed like the government was behind seeing the supply come up. And people were expecting the home price increases to be reversed. And if you go back and look at newspapers from the time, you don't find much bubble thinking. It just wasn't until the Korean War, which then created another kind of a brief bubble because people thought we might be going into World War III, so they thought they're going to shut down the construction industry again, and so that created a surge in buying briefly. But the mindset was different, and that's what I keep trying to emphasize and trying to understand is how the mindset changes through time. And it really changed between that housing boom and the 2000s boom. It was totally different.
My read, I was wondering if, to the extent that it was either government financing post-war or the introduction more broadly of a 30-year mortgage gets part of that shift and why it maintained, which also I think might justify, let's say, the 97 to 2001 or 2002 increases in prices in the U.S. I'm sympathetic between 02 and 06, and which are, of course, all price gains that have been reversed in the collapse.
You mean the introduction of the no-doc option arm and other mortgage innovations in
if not so much no-doc, then perhaps greater ability to model the arms, securitization, the ability to finance more home product through the capital markets rather than a more constrained banking system, that shift in demand would have led to sort of a one-time structural break. And would have at least started that price.
Yeah.
You know, that might be the germination of that price increase. Now, clearly, I think you're right that at some point the expectation set in that this would just continue forever and ever, and at some point that's where a bubble psychology takes over. Are you sympathetic to that view that something changed between the beginning and the end of the rise?
Well, yeah, we definitely saw a surge in securitization. That change goes back, way back. You know, it was spurred by the founding of Fannie Mae in 1938, although they didn't securitize. They just bought and held mortgages then. But then in the 1970s, with the creation of Freddie Mac and the privatization of Fannie Mae, that the government kind of created a securitization market. And I suppose that has helped increase the home ownership rate. And it probably pushed prices up somewhat in land-constrained areas, but it probably didn't have any effect on prices in areas that weren't really land-constrained because, you know, the theory says that price should equal construction cost. And if you make financing more available, then what will happen is it will have an initial increase in price, but that price will come back even though there's more financing because the construction industry will increase the supply. So I think that it is right that if you somehow make construction, if you make the mortgage market more efficient, that should boost Manhattan home prices. I don't know how to quantify how much, but in other land-constrained areas.
Okay. You mentioned, in a slightly different tag, the lack of data on home prices, and of course you created along with Chip Case, the Case-Shiller Index. How do I want to put this? That became, to a large extent, the most quoted, I think, price series during the boom. In particular, the 20 city index. But as a repeated sales index, and with the changing composition of sales over time, do you have any concerns that it has any biases to the upside or the downside? Or do you think it's just a much more accurate representation, let's say, of the original FAO or FHFA index?
Well, the FAO, you know, we go back earlier than FAO. They copied our method. So I thought FAO was similar and probably on track. Back then, they were emphasizing appraisals as part of their data set. I don't know when they brought in the purchase-only indexes, but then I think they were a little bit slow to recognize the boom and its correction because of the use of appraisals. But FAO was really on track with us. They were both repeat sales indices, and they're both subject to potential biases. The bias that was talked about most was in the aftermath of the boom was that there were a lot of foreclosure sales going on the market, and they tended to go on at low prices. And some people said we should have excluded foreclosure sales from our index. We didn't, and neither did FAO. But I think they emphasized them less, though, because they, I believe, they emphasized them less. The thing is, maybe that effect was overstated because the sale of the homeowner to the bank was not used by us, but the subsequent resale of the bank to the public was. And usually, you know, part of the decline in a foreclosure sale occurs because the homeowner neglects the house prior to foreclosure, and it has to be repaired before it's put on the market again. So we have the post-repair price in. So I don't know that it was that important. The question is, how do we deal with this? And we have a problem that the percentage of sales that were foreclosures went way up in many markets. And so we could have excluded all the foreclosures, or we could have excluded half of them. But then what does that mean? Is that going to get us the unbiased index? Now, there is a problem in measuring any of these things because the houses that were sold normally are not necessarily a random sample of all possible sales either. That often homeowners were holding out for a good price, and the only normal non-foreclosure sales that you saw were those that found ready buyers at a high price. So, you know, it's hard to know what is the true price in the market. I think it's analogous to problems with the stock market. When the stock market goes down, according to research by people, I guess it goes back 20 or 30 years in the finance journals, a lot of people hold out on those markets and refuse to sell. And you know, you could ask, you could say we should correct the stock market indices for biases in buy and sell procedures over the stock market cycle. But I just thought, Chip Case and I talked about this, that we have to do the most transparent and simple thing and represent the market as fully as possible. You know, and when a home is sold in foreclosure, it is sold, and someone can buy that. So, what are we asked to do to correct for that? I mean, it's in the market, it's available, it's up to code, it's not usually a damaged house. I think we should leave it in, and that's the thought that we had. But I admit that, you know, you could imagine wanting to do something better. But ultimately, we were creating indices that we wanted to be traded on the market. And we thought that we had to be consistent and straightforward and not get indulging in any theorizing about what the true market price would be.
Did you have any discussions on the way, as prices were really skyrocketing in 04 and 05, that there may be similar composition effects, even if you came to the same conclusion, which is you want the most transparent, simple, easy index to trade in Chicago? Were you concerned that the composition of houses that were trading in that period at the peak were also some kind of selected sample of homes?
Well, I'm trying to remember what we were thinking back then. Originally our repeat sale method was supposed to be reducing the impact of changes in compositions because as opposed to the median, which doesn't correct, we're only looking at changes in prices of homes that are sold, and not it's not affected by whether a lot of big houses are sold or a lot of little houses are sold. But now, if we're talking about 2005, I suppose you could have eliminated second home purchases as anomalous. Maybe. I mean, they're part of the market, too. There was another issue about vacation homes and shoreline homes that, but I didn't see any real reason to think that the volume of sales, maybe the volume of sales of those did go up, and we could have tried to correct for that. I mean, I have concerns about that mix that might have distorted things. But I guess the, you know, we looked at, for example, vacation homes, and we compared the price path in zip codes that were concentrated vacation areas and compared that with other zip codes. And we didn't reach any strong conclusions. I guess they tended to go up more. In some cases, they went up a lot more. I guess we just didn't, you know, we didn't know enough to want to actually take those out of the index. So I guess, you know, I wish we knew more about the housing market. We don't have perfect knowledge.
No, it's a hard problem. The data, as you point out, are not readily available. There's no, you know, I can look at the MLS listings on the internet and see every house for sale, but once they're sold, it's realtors that have the, or local recording agencies that have the true sale prices, and it's hard for people to aggregate those.
Well, you know, data problems are something we were very aware of because we went through years of trying to get the best data. And when you get down to it, some of the data is erroneous. There are errors in it as well. So it's a messy market to deal with.
Given sort of how resilient you had said some of the sort of bubble mentality was, I mean, do you think that more data would have popped that sooner, or people, I mean, you were sort of talking, you know, in 04, 05 about how you were seeing home prices skyrocket, and were people resistant to the data that was coming out even?
Well, I do remember people reacting viscerally to the data that I showed that suggested there was a bubble. And I remember people getting emotional about this, that this is not a bubble. There's something wrong here. The market is, we're not in a pinnacle capitalist system yet. This is supposed to be a capitalist country, but we have markets that don't have any professional participation. And we thought that if we were to create a futures market, or I had this other company, or I still do, Macro Markets, but again, it's not a success at this point. But we tried to create exchange-traded securities representing home prices. And we thought that if the professionals got into these markets, that would be a force making them more regular. Because it wouldn't eliminate bubbles and bursts, because we know we have them in the stock market. But at least it would probably eliminate this tremendous momentum that we have in home prices. We would have to transform the market. Home prices went up every year from 1997 to 2009. It was just so smooth, and it's just stunning to see how smooth that market has been, and how unlike a random walk that finance theory tells us to expect in speculative markets it was.
Do you have a sense of, I remember when the indices were first introduced on the in Chicago, it's the CBOT, I think, right?
I'm sorry, which indices?
Yours.
Oh no, our futures market was introduced at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange
the Merc.
In 2006. And then they merged with the Chicago Board of Trade. So now they call it the CME Group.
Okay.
But, you know.
Yeah, I remember looking at them because I thought about hedging my own house at the time. And to be honest, I couldn't figure out exactly the rollover provisions at the end of quarter. That's what got me as an anecdote. But do you have any sense to which the introduction just after that of the ABX index was in?
Oh yeah, that took our steam away because that was another way of trading home price risk.
Do you have a view
that market?
Do you have a view that that's one of the things that may have popped the bubble, for lack of a better term, the ability for those market participants who did believe the price was too high to express that view into the market?
And that popped the bubble? You're saying? Did you say popped the
yes.
bubble?
Yes. Well, could it have? That's the question.
Yeah, that sounds like an interesting theory. I'd have to look at data and timing, and I don't have that. I can't pull that up in my mind. That sounds like a possible story, and maybe it was a good thing because it popped it before it gets even more out of hand. This ABX market was just emerging right around that time, and maybe it is a product of the bubble. But we didn't have the market all along. If we had had it all along, yeah, it might have even broken it earlier before it got so bad. I don't claim to know this because I haven't really studied this as a theory, but it sounds plausible to me.
Do you have other questions about housing or indices?
Well, I have some questions that sort of stem from the subprime solution, but if you want to go through others first.
Sure. I was going to switch over eventually to sort of mentality and thinking on the street. So if you have others more related to housing, let's do those now.
Actually, mine are more in that vein, so go ahead.
So we started talking a lot about homeowners and maybe even lenders on the grounds getting caught up in the prices keep rising, and in light of that set of expectations, a lot of their actions look quite rational. Even if the belief itself is not rational, once you step back and forget the land may not be constrained. How do you view the mentality, or any particular mentality, thinking, psychology, as you've put it, of actors and market participants on Wall Street, the traders, the securitizers, up to even the boardroom? Do you have any views on sort of how their thinking changed and how their attitudes were causal to the crisis?
Well, that's a very complicated question.
You can take any part of it. I gave you the broadest canvas on which to paint.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of involved in time with my company, Macro Market. We were trying to securitize the housing market, and so we were dealing with Wall Street people a lot. And I got the impression that, well, plausibly enough, they're interested in making money, and they look, you know, they're not mostly social scientists or moral philosophers trying to decide where this country ought to go. They just wanted to know, should I be doing this month, or should I be doing trading the ABX market this month? And so it was about customer interest. And well, one thing that people complained about at that time was that it seemed like most of the money was made in OTC markets, opportunities for big profits. And so what we found is that the people who were looking at our efforts to create markets for real estate, they weren't really warm to the idea of having a futures market. And so they wanted to create some kind of over-the-counter product. And that would have happened somehow if the big-time investors were more prompt in expressing their interest. But I guess they had other markets like ABX or credit default swaps that they were already viewed as liquid active markets, and it just didn't happen in the time frame that we got much interest. And so the big time Wall Street people we were talking to just lost interest in what we were doing, and that's entirely predictable. Also, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange launched a credit default swap futures market several years ago. I don't remember the exact date. And it flopped. Again, you know, it seems that's odd because credit default swaps are so big and important. How can there not be a successful futures market? And I asked people at the CME, and I don't know if I got an answer directly from them, but my impression was that maybe part of the problem was that there was so much money being made in over-the-counter markets that professionals just didn't care. I mean, they saw other things happening in the boom, and they wanted to take their profits from it. And I don't know if that answers your question. You said you left me an open plank. So you
no, it does. We can keep on this vein for a little while. It's interesting.
It's relevant to legislation because the legislation is wanting to push things onto markets. I'll just get rid of this call now. I should.
But your impression is that these guys were very conscious about wanting to trade OTC because the bid-ask spreads are wider and the profits are greater in that market than into an exchange, you know, some kind of exchange-traded product?
That seemed to be the thing. I never understood exactly why that should be so. I never had a complete understanding. Because exchange markets are big, it's hard to get them started, I suppose. But sometimes they do get started, and it's one of these mysteries. The world is more unpredictable than you'd think when you are a student in school. We set up a business to try to create real estate securities, and we got a lot of interest, but it all fizzled. It seems to me that so much of what happens depends on timing for example, of the initial public offering market, it goes in and out. You know, there are these boom years and bust years. Sometimes people feel that they're ready to invest in something, and other times it's just not right. I tend to think, as an academic trying to understand all this, that it has to do with social epidemics of some kind or another, that fads and fashions appear in investing, and they're very strong and powerful, and they come and go. And, of course, profit-maximizing people will follow the fads and will try to stay ahead of them as much as they can, but that's part of what creates boom and bust psychology. So anyway, I was very sympathetic to Dodd-Frank, which tries to put more derivatives onto the exchanges, because it seems to me it's a healthy thing to do.
Do you have a sense, when you think about these things as fads or boom-bust cycles, that these are, these irrational kind of herding behavior, or more sort of irrational behavior? One example might be, I'm on Wall Street or I'm in a hedge fund. I may make money, I may lose money, but as long as I'm doing what everybody else is doing, my manager can't really penalize me too much.
Right, that's an important thing. I think that point was made by John Maynard Keynes in the 30s, that there is a certain kind of rational herd behavior, and that, you know, suppose you strike out and do something really different. You might imagine that could be a career moment for you if you turn out to be right. And so there's an upside as well as a downside. But a lot of people think, realistically, that there isn't as much upside as there is downside, because you'll get fired if you do something unusual and it's wrong. And that weighs heavily in their thinking. And so it's true that most people do stay with the herd and the conventional wisdom. And that's a weakness of capitalism. I don't know what to do about that weakness.
But you see that as an outcome of, you know, managerial incentives and the current organizational structure, you know, combined with, I guess, people being even a tad risk averse, right? This is going to be the rational outcome.
Right. Now, we've seen changes in incentive structures, and that's also part of Dodd-Frank. It's been, goes before, you know, and part of what happened that led to this crisis, I think, was a changing incentive structure that featured more stock options to incentivize executives. And that goes back to prior regulatory efforts, going back to Clinton, who put a cap on executive salaries but allowed executive stock options. So we do create, we have created incentives that are off, and we're trying to fix them. The Dodd-Frank bill has a section on executive compensation, and I think it has yet to be worked out what they're going to do. Some people complain that your report is coming out after Dodd-Frank, and it's unfortunate timing, but I don't view it as that unfortunate, because Dodd-Frank is anything but a final document now. It's a beginning of a... So your report will help regulators interpret what they're going to do under Dodd-Frank.
Do you have more specific, aside from stock compensation and tying executive compensation,
to a greater degree to success of the firm or to the shorter term profits of the firm. I assume that's what you have in mind. Do you have other ideas about the role of compensation perhaps in causing the crisis?
Well, I have another group I'm affiliated with, the Squam Light Group, and we have a book that just came out this summer, and it has a chapter on executive compensation. And I wrote about this in my New York Times column, which is a monthly column I have. And Barney Frank talked to me afterwards and said he thought it was interesting. And now I think we're going to have hearings that include one of our members. But the idea was that we expressed was that companies should hold back a fraction of CEO and top executive salaries and not pay it out for at least a number of years. And that payout would then not occur if the firm either went bankrupt or was bailed out by the government. And this is a basic thing to try to internalize to the CEO some of the costs that are currently borne by taxpayers. So that was a little compensation idea that we thought would actually be constructive. And the problem is that it's very hard. There's a whole branch of the financial theory called agency theory that gets at how to manage incentives. And it's complicated. There's no way to get an agent to do exactly what you would do. If you look at the executive compensation section in the Dodd-Frank bill, it is a little bit vague, and I think it allows for regulators to impose something like what I'm talking about, and I think Barney Frank thinks so too.
I've seen the Squam Lake report. Did you guys have particular evidence, though, just to push a little bit further on, you know, at which level of the firm there may have been bad incentives or misaligned incentives, either between the agency problems generally viewed often between the manager and the worker, between the principal and the agent in that sense. But people have argued that, for example, at least, you know, Wall Street's overall incentives diverged from that which the social planner would have wanted. Do you have a sense of whose incentives were really sort of skewed during the crisis?
Well, see, the social planner would be worried about systemic effects. And that is not something that a CEO worries about, because it's a system-wide thing. It's not his problem. He doesn't care if he's the one card that is pulled out and causes the whole house of cards to collapse. That's why we, in our report, wanted to have the executive actually penalized for a systemic crisis, which we thought would bring on bailouts. But not that it would ever make him fully internalize the risk, the systemic risk that he was creating. So I think there has to be more than, it's not just an executive compensation solution, that we actually have to regulate capital requirements. Well, the really important thing that hasn't really happened effectively with Dodd-Frank or with Basel III is bringing more financial firms under the wing of capital controls and leverage regulation. The Dodd-Frank allows that to happen if the Financial Services Oversight Council is willing to designate a financial firm as a threat to the stability of the economy. But it doesn't seem to call for any wholesale incorporation of all of the people who were involved in the run on the repo or who were involved in the systemic effects of the crisis under Fed regulation. So I'm worried that we really haven't confronted the shadow banking system problem that has developed. And it could happen under Dodd-Frank if the regulators are aggressive enough and smart enough to do it. I hope it will, but it's not a clear closed case that it will happen.
I'll let Steve jump in here for a minute, and then maybe we'll come back. We have some time for questions about the shadow banking and your views on those markets. But let Steve take over for a little while.
A couple of questions, Professor, from your book, The Subprime Solution.
Yeah.
There's one of the passages in it, and is the loss of trust in the economic system can have consequences not only for the economy itself, but for the social fabric as a whole. I wonder if you can identify where the tipping point is and how close we came to it.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that I think the anger level in this country is still rising. So we just learned the NBER said the recession was over in June of last year. But I think that the anger level is even higher. And the unemployment rate has not come down substantially, even though the recession is over. And it may drag on for years. So we're in an environment now where maybe half the population feels threatened that they might lose their job eventually, or they have already lost their job. And I think that is hurting the social fabric, and I don't know how far it will go. I remember talking to Tom Petruno, who writes a column for the LA Times, who's an interesting guy. You might want to talk to him too. But he was telling me a couple of years ago that he was astonished at how much really angry email he got. Angry in the sense that they wanted to kill somebody, or they used obscene language and description. If you look up Nancy Pelosi on blogs, go do a blog search. The amount of, I just pick her as an example. The amount of obscene rhetoric and the threatening rhetoric that's out there is just astonishing to me. So I don't know how to measure this. It has me worried. And it seems like the Tea Party movement that we're observing seems harmless and patriotic in a way, but I worry about other movements that might develop if this continues.
This anger raises another observation in your book that I think has a bearing on all issues related to regulation and accountability, but you wrote, much as we would like to, we cannot easily sort out who is at fault and who is not. And I wonder there are no evildoers, to quote a former president, and is that the case?
Well, I wouldn't say there are. I would put Barney Madoff in as an evildoer. But I don't know that the percent of people who are, psychopaths has gone up in our economy. And so we do have to give credit. And, our incentive system should obviously give credit to people who have high moral integrity and hold back from responding to ill incentives. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't punish evildoers. I'm not apologizing for them. But it seems to me that there's a tendency, and I think when you write up your report, you'll have to resist the tendency to pander to an audience that might want you to pin it on certain malefactors. Your book, by the way, will be a bestseller, I'm predicting. Everyone will be reading it. But you shouldn't get carried away in appealing to the readers. As an academic, I don't know if you asked for all my advice on this, but as an academic, I would like to see some recognition of the more pedestrian or normal reaction that produced this kind of crisis.
Meaning what kind of reaction?
Well, it's kind of human nature brings these crises on, and there's going to be an element who want to blame it excessively on regulators who were incompetent or politically motivated in the wrong way, and I think that those, I don't see a lot of that in my view of the world. I tend to think of regulators as well-meaning and intelligent people who may have had shortcomings because of the kind of economic theory that was commonly accepted. And a lot of people seem to do bad things, but if you were there, you might have seen how it happened.
Is it reasonable in that sense? And this is, forgive me, this is sort of a grand stretch. But you know, sometimes I think about the crisis is an agency theory problem, it's so many people operating with so many different incentives, so many different goals that agency theory kind of lies at the heart of this.
Yeah. It does lie at the heart of it, and so I think that progress in our modern society is substantially progress in agency theory. A lot of the things that have happened are defined by new incentive structures. So, for example, hedge funds have grown a lot over the last 20 years, and it's really a different incentive structure for portfolio managers. That's one. Another is private equity. Again, it seems like private equity has flourished as a different. The industry has gotten some more creative incentive systems that seem to be working. Whether these incentive systems have systemic effects, then, is another issue that may not have been worked out.
This last thought is a comment, not a question. But you mentioned Aaron Sapolsky and the opening line of his book, "America from Its Inception Was a Speculation." I mean, it suggests that we're always going to have risk, we're always going to have speculation. And then you remind the image of George Washington as a speculator. And one of my favorite images from American history is George Washington visiting the Prune Street Prison in Philadelphia to his friend Robert Morris, the first Secretary of the Treasury, who ended up in jail because of land speculation.
Oh, I didn't know that story. And Washington actually went and visited him in jail?
He went and visited him in Prune Street Jail. Supposedly, somehow I wanted to figure out what to do with that image, but there he was.
That's a great
not too long before Washington died, it must have been about 18, and there was the first, Robert Morris was instrumental and somewhat controversial in raising money during the American Revolution. But he got money to the troops, and he ended up in prison over because he bought too much land.
Yeah.
Ask Will Getzman about that. He knows all about it.
Yeah, okay. It's a good story. I love it. But it's true that the American Republic was founded by speculators and adventuresome people, and I think that we have to let that happen to some extent. It's something that drives creativity, and so booms and busts like this are not the end of the world, and they may be part of the social drama that drives capitalism. So, I mean, Schumpeter called it creative destruction, mm-hmm. but maybe he didn't emphasize booms, bubbles, and busts as much as I would. I'm sure he talks about it, but the idea though is that there is fundamental uncertainty about the future, and people take personal identity to certain views, and they want to see what happens. It's following their lives and connected with the certain ideas about where the economy is going. And this is a society of grown-ups. We let people do that, and ultimately, I think, leads to great things. The GDP growth in this country has been something like 3% a year for the last century, depending on how you measure it exactly, but it's been really dramatic, and it's been this capitalist system that has gone through repeated booms and busts over that time. So let's not overreact to this. And I think that we really need to see our financial system invigorated by the reforms that we have now. So part of what Dodd-Frank does, for example, putting more things on markets, that seems to me invigorating to the financial system, because it now has prices that are widely quoted and available to everyone. I should have shut this off. Sorry about that. So I'm going to shut it off now. So
do you have a sense, staying on this sort of psychology theme, when we got to fall of 2008, post Lehman and WaMu and Wachovia, that's where the economy heads into a massive tailspin, with GDP collapsing at 6.4% annual rate or something of the sort.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense for how much of that is or was driven by, let's say, wealth effects from this collapse of the housing bubble, which we spoke about at the beginning of this conversation, versus an almost psychological fear, the opposite of an irrational exuberance, whatever an irrational panic
right.
might be? Do you have a sense of the relative magnitudes or how to think about that?
Well, we have, I wrote a paper about wealth effects in housing with Chip Case and John Quigley. And we wrote that several years ago. We now have new data, or John Quigley has processed it, and he claims that the wealth effect, when you include the bubble and burst recently, is much stronger. So there is a strong housing wealth effect. But, again, the question that you're asking is deeper. We can estimate a wealth effect, but how much of that is due to the pure budget constraint, right, that I know now that I have less housing wealth to borrow against, and how much of that is due to the psychology of the movement in home prices after a major correction. And we don't really disentangle that in the theory. So the wealth effect theory says the pure wealth effect theory says I look upon my house as something that yields housing services, but it's something that I can sell eventually, and I can borrow against it in the meantime, and I will just diminish the net worth when I do sell it. And so when the value goes down, I just reassess my consumption expenditure based on the assumption that nothing else has changed but the wealth component of my budget constraint. That's the pure theory. I don't know how to evaluate that theory. I think that it's really must be at least substantially the general psychology or general... The zeitgeist changes from time to time, and that the fall in consumption that we've seen recently is not, I don't think, I'm just saying based on my intuition and my broad reading of behavioral economics, that is not to be understood well as a pure wealth effect. It has to do with the uncertainty, the anxiety about possible future unemployment, the sense of betrayal by government forces who bailed out rich people and are not on my side and makes me wonder about my future Social Security. There's a whole swirl of ideas that are affected by the decline in home prices. And so,
did the government just bail out rich people, or... Should we view TARP and the like as having saved the credit intermediation?
Well, I think TARP was a good thing. I support it. I think that I was just referring to the public's reaction to it.
I understood. I just wanted to get your opinion about the bailouts and because one other thing that happened in that same time period, of course, is lending constricted at an incredible rate, which has also some effect on the real economy. And that's something that's often not seen by the American people.
Right. Well, I think that's more esoteric. Well, lending on mortgages would have contracted really strongly, but then the Fed began buying mortgage-backed securities, and Fannie and Freddie were put under conservatorship, and FHA continued to do its mortgage insurance. All those things kept the housing market looking much more normal, and so people never saw the lending in their own personal experience. They never saw much of a decline, and so they don't imagine what could have happened if we hadn't done these bailout things. I guess that's what Bernanke and the others and Paulson must have hoped for, that most people will stay complacent if you let them stay complacent. And they won't know why it is that nothing terrible happened. That was that, but to some extent, people really were panicked by the Lehman Brothers event. I think that was a kind of a flashback to the Great Depression, that kind of event, and the anxiety that it created right afterwards.
More so than Bear Stearns or anything else?
Well, you know, Lehman Brothers was the big event when they allowed a major actor to go down. And I don't know that people understood interest rate spreads, but those who did were making noises that this is a very uncomfortable time. And so it was around that time that Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey has a sort of a depression question about whether you think we might have another depression. And the number of people worrying about a depression reached a record, close to a record at that time. So I think Lehman Brothers did a real trick on people's imaginations and reminded them of awful things that weren't supposed to happen anymore.
Were you, go ahead.
No, please.
Were you surprised by the Lehman outcome?
Well, I didn't know what would happen. I didn't know what would happen to interest rate spreads. I was worried about what would happen. I guess what surprised me most was the quickness of the recovery. By March of 2009, we were back at least a booming stock market, and we saw a recovery in the housing market. Those events did surprise me. I wouldn't have said that they couldn't happen, but I didn't expect them to happen, especially with the housing market. You know, the turnaround in the housing market that came after ARRA and after the tax credit was announced was like the sharpest we've ever seen. It also made me worry that it wasn't sustainable.
So, how close were we to really bad outcomes? Do you share the Bernanke view of the world that without TARP and a lot of the other guarantee programs, we were headed towards 1930-style collapse?
Well, nobody will ever know. I take him as giving a real warning. I think that, we do have a sort of almost 1930s-style collapse now with the unemployment rate at 9.6%. The unemployment rate in 1937 got down to, I believe, 12.2. So that's within shooting distance of where we are right now, and that was the middle of the Depression. Our long-term unemployment rate is at record high since the post-war period when they first started calculating it. So it seems like we're close enough now to depression. It's not the depression, but it's not so far away. If we hadn't done those things, yeah, I think the unemployment rate might have shot up over 12.2% easily, and it would put us in the range that was observed in the Depression.
So aside from, I think that covers most of what I was hoping to, aside from your admonition, or your warning, I guess it was an admonition, that we resist the temptation to, you know, to blame somebody, but rather look at this, I guess, more holistically or systemically, are there other areas that the Commission should investigate, should try to shed more light on, or, you know, particular parts of the crisis that we should be very cognizant of describing in the book or trying to make clear? You know, how do we make our value added as high as possible?
Yeah, that's a big and difficult question again. But I actually think, you know, if we look at my book with Akerlof, we have a chapter on corruption. And so I think that it's really appropriate that you do look at fraud and corruption, which I guess the Congress gave you as your charge to do. But it is part of the cycle, and it's more of a criminologist perspective that there are forces that encourage this kind of activity at one time or another and try to understand them. And also to think about what kind of regulations might yet be adopted that will change the incentives. But I think that you are right to do work on trying to frame out how important the decline in our ethical standards was. So we talked about it as not just corruption, but also decline in good faith. That's an ancient word in Latin, bona fide, good faith. That means you do business the way you would with your relative. And I won't do a deal with you if it's not, you know, plausibly in your interest. And I'll tell you. And we saw a decline in that. I don't know whether you talk to people about a sense of good faith. But the people who issued these subprime mortgages, for example, were not acting in good faith. And the motivation for some of these business was, well, everyone else is doing it, you know, so I guess it's okay. And I don't know whether you talked to people, you probably did talk to people about their perceptions about that.
You are correct. I mean, sort of fraud and misdealing, particularly in the housing market, is one of the 22 causes that Congress has tasked us with investigating. So we are doing our best.
I looked at the list of causes that Congress mentioned, and they do seem to be, they don't seem to be asking you to get down to the ultimate causes the way I would be inclined to do. But then that takes you into social science. But it's unfortunate if that's the case, because you are supposed to contribute understanding to the crisis, and you don't want to write up a report that just says, just a bunch of evil people suddenly appeared. It's better that you write a report like, there have been various reports about crime in the United States, right? I can't remember the exact dates, but in this, wasn't there some major report in the 70s or so about the rising levels of crime? Mm-hmm. And they would talk about social conditions that brought on the crime. So I think that it's a similar thing here, right? That you want to talk about the extent of fraud and bad faith, but try to think constructively.
My job, actually, Professor, part of what I'm doing is to look at what we're calling the prelude to the crisis, which is to say, in the post World War II era, where does this crisis begin? And have you given any thought to teaching a course on the crisis of the financial crisis?
I'm sorry, I teach?
Have you given any, what I imagine is if you were teaching a course on the financial crisis of 2002, 2008, 2009, where would you begin that class?
With what year?
Yeah, what year?
I would go back to 97 at least, because I think of the housing boom as a smooth process that began around 1997 and continued. If you look at a plot of home prices, they just went up. It's almost like a perfect cubic polynomial. So,
what about the growth of the shadow banking industry? Would that be part of it?
And that is part of it. And it goes back to 1980 with the depository institutions decontrol and monetary control. I didn't say that exactly right.
I know. Didma. Why does that one leap out?
Because that's when they eliminated usury laws that prevented a subprime industry from even existing. And so when they allowed subprime lenders to charge enough interest rate to make a profit, they generated a whole new industry. And they didn't put it under regulation. And the industry was not properly regulated. And in fact, mortgage brokers, for example, were generally not even licensed. So anybody could become a mortgage broker, and they could launch that business with no training. And you got ex-cons who would go into this business because it was an avenue for them. And we just didn't license it because I guess the government was too busy doing other things. It was the Reagan era where deregulation was the mood, and so it wasn't the time where it was politically feasible to launch a whole new regulatory agency. So the industry just kind of grew unregulated, And the industry is, it's a good thing. I think we can live with a subprime industry that charges higher interest rates to questionable borrowers. But we don't want it to be populated by crooks.
Right.
We don't want it to be. And there's something to be said for the kind of licensing and professional education and continuing education that professionals in other fields have that they're subject to. And so we just didn't do that. And it was just not on the national radar that all this was happening. Now that is being changed. They're bringing mortgage brokers under licensing now, for example.
Right. Right.
So what other parts... So aside from the sort of bubble mentality and getting swept up on it, are there other sort of broader sort of themes, sociologic trends that we should try to highlight? Or is that the one that you most often focus on?
Well, I don't know about sociological trend. I think that...
Call it a psychological trend. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But this, but these sort of bigger themes you alluded to...
One bigger theme is financial innovation. And people are skeptical now of financial innovation because they think what comes to their mind first, it's residential mortgage-backed securities, especially of the subprime variety. And it was thought, and also special purpose vehicles that were used to defraud or to disguise the truth about a balance sheet. That does seem to be the dominant, the most looked at financial innovation. If the government is not attentive to the kind of regulations, the changes it makes in its regulations, you get a lot of regulations arbitrage innovations. But I think the government has to think about encouraging really creative financial innovation. So the idea of putting derivatives on exchanges, that's one such thing that was put in by the Dodd-Frank bill. And I guess before that, the administration tried to get industry support for it goes back to Geithner and before he was Treasury Secretary. Mm-hmm. So we're doing things like that, and I'd like to see more things like that. But this is a particular purpose of mine. I do believe that a modern civil society is pushed ahead by financial innovation, and that I'm giving a lecture at Princeton on October 14th about financial innovation and its importance in civil society, and we tend to forget that. And I'm worried that your report will look too much at the scandals and not at the benefits of, in looking at the benefits of financial innovation, I like to compare, for example, the earthquake in Haiti with the earthquake in San Francisco many years earlier. And the loss of life and the loss of property was so much lower in San Francisco. And I kind of attribute that to a modern insurance industry who then imposed building codes and safety procedures that it was the incentive to do those things was mediated by an insurance company, by insurance companies. So I think that we have to see finance. I talk about these in subprime solutions, but that's a particular idea that I. Now, actually, if you look at Dodd-Frank, there's a section in there in which they asked HUD to do a study of shared appreciation mortgages. And that's an interesting financial innovation if Dodd-Frank gets that going. Because a real cause of this crisis was not just psychology, it was the leverage situation that homeowners are routinely put into. We have a conventional wisdom that homeowners are reliable and responsible to buy a house with a 90% or more mortgage. And that put them in a leveraged position that made them very vulnerable to any correction in home prices. So I'm glad to see that Dodd-Frank has provided for at least a study of an alternative kind of mortgage that wouldn't put people in such a perilous situation. and there we do have financial innovation. But, you know, the Dodd-Frank bill can't innovate itself. All that it did is create a study of the potential for that. I think it has to come from society at large, and we have to also have regulators who are open to innovation and can see advantages of regulation that of new kinds of financial products that might look to some people self-interested or risky in some sense, but which on longer, deeper inspection can be seen to be helping people.
Your earthquake and Haiti and San Francisco does also support the case for self-regulation.
Well, that's another thing, is that's a particular strength of the United States, that we have relied on self-regulatory organizations or trade groups to police themselves. And that's what I call civil society. It's not all from the government. That the government represents the will of the people, but the will of the people is to see things go well and not necessarily to have everything run by the government. And so we have private groups that make rules for themselves, and that's often the best way to go, because the private groups understand. There has to be oversight, though, because private groups can sometimes be selfish.
It's not their job to be magnanimous.
Well, that's the question. Under extreme capitalist theory, we would say that their job is to maximize profits and that alone. But I think that is that's not actually capitalist theory per se. People often go back to Adam Smith as the expositor of capitalist theory, and if you look at what he says, it doesn't seem to me at all that he's advocating that business people should pursue profit exclusively. And I've been reading his theory of moral sentiments, and it doesn't seem to be that at all. That he recognized, and this is Adam Smith, the inventor of capitalism, he recognized that most people want to be, he said any normal person wants to be a good, I'm not quoting him exactly, but wants to be a good citizen or contributor to society. And that he thought that that's what makes the system work. That I can't quote him exactly, but the idea that we should be exclusively, business people should be exclusively bent on making profits, it doesn't sound exactly right to me. I mean, you could say they should be staying within the letter of the law, and within that they should then just pursue profits. But even that seems a little bit too restrictive. There has to be some sense that business people stay in good faith in accordance with the true intent of the law, and they do that out of principle, and that's what we want. And doing that requires some creative thinking, promoting social and goals for the people and not just the company.
And given that's a very hard task. I mean, as you point out, if it's just a letter of the law and you are in a dynamic situation with financial innovation, it's not obvious a regulatory system or a legal system can keep up. So you're stuck relying on bona fides.
Right. And it goes back, like, for example, the Goldman case, where, I don't know whether you talked about it, we are going to talk about this, where they arranged, I'm trying to remember the details now, they arranged a portfolio of securities where one side was allowed to pick them. It was shorting. Was that John Paulson?
It was John Paulson and the Abacus, yeah. And the Abacus deal.
Yeah, and the question is, were they remiss? And I can't say I've studied this case, but it seems to me to come down where it's subtle, but. Good faith investing means that, I was saying, good faith business means that you wouldn't do business that you wouldn't do with a relative or someone that you cared about. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't let somebody make mistakes that they're making, and because it's their responsibility. So good faith is hard to define. I think it requires some good legal minds to think through all of the implications. I'm not taking a position on Goldman here.
We understand.
I don't know enough about it to place blame on that.
Thanks. Well, with that warning that we should take this broader view and these broader themes. If there are any others, you should please let us know.
And I hope we can get back to you if we have a question arising.
This has been very helpful and very informative to us, and we very, very much thank you for your time.
Okay, well, I look forward to seeing your report, too, which I think will be a big success.
Great.
thank you for the encouragement.
All right.
Take care, Professor.
Thank you.
All right, bye.